Out of the Silence, a lecture by Ianthe Hoskins. Born in Italy, Miss Hoskins has been a resident of England since childhood and received her master's degree in education from London University. A member of the Theosophical Society since 1936, she is the current General Secretary of the English Section. Multilingual in French, German, Spanish, and English, she has lectured internationally for the Society for many years. Some of her published works include The Science of Spirituality, Foundations of Esoteric Philosophy, and Selected Studies in the Secret Doctrine.
Thank you very much. As soon as I heard that the overall theme of the convention was to be the roar of silence, I knew what I wanted to talk about. And what I want to talk about, what I shall talk about, is a little book. This little book, which has been in the family for, it must be well over 60 years, and it is called Out of the Silence. And you can see the connection between the roar of silence and Out of the Silence. Now, this little book is a long poem. And one of my sisters and I, who liked it very much, used to memorize it. And our technique, which I offer to any of you who are interested in memorizing, whether prose or verse, we balanced it on the taps while we were washing up in the kitchen, and we recited alternate verses. And that is an excellent way of doing it, and so I recommend it to you. Now, the author, James Rhodes, is unknown. I never heard of him except in one other connection, and that was when I was a student doing Latin at university. We were doing the fourth book of Virgil's Aeneid, and somehow, I suppose it must have been in the college library, there was a translation in blank verse by James Rhodes of Virgil Aeneid Book 4. And that was the first time, I think, that I met his name, the one and only time apart from this little book. Whether he has done more, I simply cannot say. But if ever you come across him, I hope you will let me know. Meanwhile, this is one of my treasures, and I have wanted to share it. And I have wanted so much, and it has been out of print for a very long time, that in 1978, I think it was, I persuaded our publishing house to get permission, although in fact it was out of copyright. I think we did not require permission, but still we did secure permission to bring out our own edition. I think you will. It is my conviction that when you know all that is in this poem, some of you who like your philosophy in verse will wish to possess a copy, balance it on the taps if you can, memorize it, and then share it with more people. Now, the theme of the poem is indicated by the text which precedes the first part. It is in two parts, a short introductory section in one verse form, a simple ballad meter, and a simple rhyme form of A-B-A-B. And then the rest, the major part of the work, 75 verses, in the meter of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which I'm sure is known to some of you. Now, the dedication at the beginning gives an idea of the theme, because the work is dedicated, let me read it from versions I have, to all who through the gate of silence and with the Master's key seek the kingdom that is within them. In fact, it is a curious thing that occurs in our summer schools, and I expect it occurs in yours, that although there is no collusion between speakers beforehand, somehow they seem to hit the same note or a similar note. And I felt that Ed Abdul's introduction yesterday was echoing the same thought in a different form, but essentially that, the divine within. To all who through the gate of silence and with the Master's key seek the kingdom that is within them. And especially to, and here there are two names, a certain James Mills, M.D., U.S.A. What his connection with the United States is, I don't know, whether he was a United States citizen or whether he got his medical qualification here in the United States. And a lady who is apparently his wife, by whose unlocking of that gate, many hopeless sufferers have been made whole and happy. That is the dedication of it. And then the preface goes further. It says that the object of the poem is to convey the doctrine that by conscious union with the indwelling principle of life, man may attain completeness here and now. By conscious union with the indwelling principle of life. Now, I must do a little bit of sales talk. I hope the board of TPH is listening. The text that precedes the poem is 1 Corinthians 3:16. Now, it is possible that one or two of my friends who have been with me before during the past few months or elsewhere will have heard me say 1 Corinthians 3:16. Ah. But actually, to my surprise, there was one member in New York who knew 1 Corinthians. In my life, in the last 30 years, I have met exactly two people who could tell me what 1 Corinthians 3:16 says. And one was last week in New York. Well, what St. Paul says there is, know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? Question. Did St. Paul know what he was talking about? If he did, what next? What happens if indeed man is the temple of God? I said I was going to do some sales talk. Last year, we had the pleasure of having some of you at our European Congress. And I was one in celebration of two things, the anniversary, the centenary of the secret doctrine, and the centenary of the English section. And so we had our president, Rada Bernier, with us, as well as distinguished visitors from the United States and from other parts of the world. And I was one of the people asked to prepare a talk. And I chose as my theme, St. Paul in the Secret Doctrine. And I worked rather hard to try to collect some ideas. And then 2 or 3 weeks before the event, I happened to call at our bookshop. And I mentioned to, as you know him, Leslie Price, some of you know him, I mentioned to him, oh, you know, I'm doing St. Paul in the Secret Doctrine. Whereupon he said, have you seen this? And he produced the New Testament commentaries of H.P. Blavatsky by a gentleman called Spierenberg. Now this, for anyone who lectures on that theme, is an absolutely indispensable treasure. The New Testament commentaries of H.P. Blavatsky. Every reference that she makes anywhere in Isis, in the Key, in the Secret Doctrine, and in the collected writings, all there, beautifully indexed. So you can look at it either from the angle of the of HPB's writings, or if you know a particular text, you look it up under a different index, and you find what you want. And there are at least seven, if it isn't more, I think it may be nine, but at least seven references that HPB makes to 1 Corinthians 3:16. Sometimes quoting it in full, sometimes a very obvious reference to it using some of the words or some of the ideas. Now you will immediately rush to the bookshop and order a book. I said I would do some sales talk. Now the poem is a commentary, a verse commentary on 1 Corinthians 3:16. And so it begins by going over the statement that St. Paul makes and considering, now if it is true, if we are the temple of God, what follows? Can it be true? And so the poet says, is this thing true? The preacher said, all but a dreamer's dream. The question of, is that power which made the whole universe, is that same power within man? And if it is, what follows? So, is this thing true, the preacher saith, all but a dreamer's dream? Thrills in thy very midst the breath that bade the star fires stream, framed all the universe divine, and slowly, cell by cell, built up thy body for a shrine wherein himself might dwell? If so, what follows? Now, what follows leads me to a very important passage in the Secret Doctrine, part of the commentary on stanza 6, on the beginnings of our humanity and on the incarnation of divine beings in vehicles already prepared. Another of the poems, which some of us were looking at Crotona in January, includes these lines that it says, we are not of earth, we do not come from the earth, for we come of heavenly lineage, of a pure, undying race. We who took the poppied potion of our life and quaffing deep, move enchanted now forever in the shadow world of sleep, in the vast and lovely image that is wrought of time and space. We are not of earth. And HPB is commenting on the physical body of man. And he asks the question, how comes our physical body to the state of perfection it is found in now? And if you, about 10 days ago, were watching Wimbledon, you must have had some moments as always at this time of year, of admiration at what a physical body can do. And she answers her own question. Yes, indeed. Indeed, the physical body of man has come through evolution, but not through or from animals. And then she likes to quote. Now, as I say, she likes to quote, it was probably either M or KH who put the ideas into her head, because I don't think she can ever have found time to read our Victorian authors. But, as you know, KH went to a university, he went to Oxford for a time, I think, and he picked up some English literature on the way. And he liked to quote it, and possibly he suggested this to her. One of the authors who is probably never read now, Thomas Carlyle. In 1840, Thomas Carlyle gave a series of lectures in London on heroes and hero worship. They were published under that title. And it is from that book, Carlyle on Heroes, that HBB now quotes. So the next words that I'm going to read are from Carlyle on the human body. The essence of our being, the mystery in us that calls itself I. What words have we for such things? It is a breath of heaven. The highest being reveals himself in man. This body, these faculties, this life of ours, is it not all as a vesture for that unnamed? And at this point, Carlyle himself quotes. And so HBB quotes Carlyle quoting. So you have it several times back. Carlyle quotes from the German philosopher who wrote under the name of Novalis. And so HPB quotes the quotation. And Novalis said, "There is but one temple in the universe, and that is the body of man." You'll find all this in that commentary on stanza 6 of Secret Doctrine, Volume 1. There is but one temple in the universe, and that is the body of man. Nothing is holier than that high form. Bending before men is a reverence done to the revelation in the flesh. Now, I don't know what Novalis had in mind, but it made me think immediately of what some of us learn at Adyar, Namaste. Bending before man is a reverence done to the revelation in the flesh. We touch heaven when we lay our hands on a human body. At that point, Carlyle comments and says, well, you may think these are just a lot of fancy words, a lot of rhetoric, saying all these things. But no, he says, it is not. If well meditated, it will turn out to be a scientific fact, the actual truth of the thing. We are the miracle of miracles. Now let us go back to the poem. If it is true that man is the temple of the Most High, what happens? What follows? And the poet answers, then cares and fears be phantoms vain, ills of illusion bred. O hungry soul, insatiate brain, ope inward and be fed. O heart, with age-long error rife, thou art no soil for sin, where through the eternal fount of life streams ever from within. Drink, and thy need shall be sufficed, the drought of death shall fly. Who thereof drinketh, saith the Christ, shall never thirst or die. And then there follow two verses which I quote as many times as I can make an excuse for quoting them, and I would like to hope that someone here and there memorizes them and uses them also. You see, when we say the Lord's Prayer, we end up by saying, "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory." But if we are one with the divine, if the divine is within, then whose are the kingdom, the power, and the glory? The impression is given in popular Christianity that you have to wait for the power, the kingdom, and the glory. You wait until you are dead. And I say, what is the good of that? What is the good of that? And it is quite contrary to the teaching of the ancient wisdom. It is here. The heaven is here for which we wait. The life eternal, now. Who is this Lord of time and fate? Thou, brother, sister, thou. The power, the kingdom is thine own. Arise, O royal heart. Press inward, past the doubting zone, and prove the God thou art. It's very powerful indeed, but it is only an elaboration of what St. Paul has affirmed. Ye are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwelleth in you. We use, I know it is only idiomatic, but it does tend to colour one's thinking, that we have to go to heaven. Where is heaven? And that immortality is time stretched out indefinitely. But as HPB says in The Key, immortality is a state of unbroken consciousness. Nothing to do with time at all. A quality of consciousness. Hence the affirmation of the poem, the heaven is here for which we wait, the life eternal, now. Now the whole poem is an exploration of this same theme. And so now we are going to pass to the meter of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. In one respect, the theme is presented, the approach is similar to that of the Bhagavad Gita. That is, the Divine Lord speaks to his disciple. Krishna speaks to Arjuna. And some of our writers and commentators have said, we can treat this in other ways, the higher self speaking to the lower self, God speaking to the human soul. And this poem uses rather the language of God speaking to the human soul, but we can take it in any of these ways. Certainly the higher speaking to the lower. The divine in man speaking to the human personal self. The title is taken from the first verse here, which is just an introduction to the major part with the meter of the Rubaiyat. Lo, in the vigils of the night, ere sped the first bright arrows from the Orient shed, the heart of silence trembled into sound, and out of vastness came a voice which said, now that's just the prelude, lo, in the vigils of the night, ere sped the first bright arrows from the Orient shed, the heart of silence trembled into sound, and out of vastness came a voice which said. And so all the rest of the poem is written in the first person, I, and the I is that divine that speaks to the soul of man. There is one line that in the passage that HPB quotes, as she is about to introduce the stanzas in volume one, she quotes a page, nearly a page, from the Rig Veda, the oldest of the great Vedas of India. And there is one line in that quotation, in that passage, which says everything. You don't need anything else. If we know that line and the implications of that line, we do not need to study anything else, but just explore all that that one line says. To me, it is the most important line in all our literature, in all literature. And it says simply this, other than it, there nothing since has been. Other than it, that, the divine life, the one reality. We use a lot of words to refer to it, but there never has been anything else. That is the only thing there is. Other than it, there nothing since has been. So the next two verses dwell on this theme, the one who is the source of all. I am alone. Thou only art in me. I am the stream of life that flows through thee. I comprehend all substance, fill all space. I am pure being by whom all things be. I am thy dawn from darkness to release. I am the deep wherein thy sorrows cease. Be still and know that I am God. Acquaint thyself with me and be at peace. Those two lines, be still, suggest the teaching of Patanjali. Verses 2 and 3, forget about all the others, rather complicated here and there, but verses 2 and 3 of book one. So what do they say? Well, verse 2 defines yoga. In simple language, yoga is the stilling of the mind, to make the mind absolutely quiet. And then verse 3 tells us the consequence, what will happen if we ever succeed in doing it. Then the seer stands in his own nature. He knows what he is. And so the great union has taken place, but only when the mind is still. Be still and know that I am God. Acquaint thyself with me and be at peace. Now, If there is but one, as the Rig Veda says, all dualities, all multiplicities are temporary appearances only. Last night, Ed used that illustration of the ocean and the waves. The waves are temporary appearances on the surface of the ocean. But the only reality is the ocean. Without that, no waves. And in fact, in their essential nature, the waves are identical with the ocean. So that all else, all temporary appearances are, in philosophical language, known as the unreal. The unreal, Sismagistra says at the end of the SD1, there is a passage from a hermetic treatise in which Sismagistra says clearly, that which has beginning and end and which changes is not real. So the real is only that which endures without beginning, without end, and without change. All else is called unreal. And here I must give you another of my favorite quotations, Bhagavad Gita 2.16. So there we are, Bhagavad Gita 2.16. What does that say in Annie Besant's translation? The unreal hath no being. It doesn't count. The unreal hath no being. The real never ceaseth to be. It always is. The real always is. And it is the only thing which is that eternal, that than which there is nothing else. And HPB makes use of this thought in number 3 of the esoteric papers at the end of the Adyai edition, volume 5, or you find it published in other places. Esoteric paper number 3, where she says she had some difficulty in making the London theosophists understand. Well, there are different kinds of theosophists, and I expect the London ones were not much worse than others. But they were reared in Victorian England, and Victorian England was brought up on a Christianity that made a clear division between God and man. And it must have been extraordinarily difficult, and I think it still is difficult, to recognize the one, that there is no such division. There is no God up there other than the universe and the laws of the universe, the one reality which is expressed in the many. And so HPB says, if only those theosophists could understand that if there is only the one reality, which the Hindus call Parabrahman or Paramatman, then it must follow. We must have come from it, and we must one day return to it. Why? We must have come from it because there is nowhere else to come from. And we must return to it because there is nowhere else to go to. And then she doesn't herself say what the third thing that follows, but she leaves Arya Sangha to say it. And what he says is we must be it. We must have come from it, we must go back to it, and we must be it. You know those magnificent 6.5 lines of Arya Sangha, which give you the whole of theosophy. Well, I've already said it's in one line of the Rig Veda. But if you want a little bit more, then you must have 6.5 lines of Arya Sangha. That which is neither spirit nor matter, neither light nor darkness, but is verily the container and root of these, that thou art. That thou art. But he ends up the paragraph, but you do not know. And that is the purpose of the exercise, to know what indeed we are. Having introduced the theme of the oneness, the identity of man with the source of all life, James Rhodes, the author, he then turns to the constitution of man, the nature of man. Referring to the Pauline system, and I think you will find the mention of it in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse something like 25. Now, do not think that I am clever to know that as a text, because I will tell you how it happened. I was at one time doing a little work just a few months ago, and I wanted to know where St. Paul mentions that man has three aspects, body, soul, and spirit. And I had been thinking of that, and I didn't know where to look, and I hadn't got a concordance to help me to find it. And then one of our members, who is also a clergyman, rang me up about some other matter, and I said, look, while you're on the phone, please will you tell me where St. Paul says body, soul, and spirit. And he said, well, I'll tell you, just a moment, I'll ring you back. And within 5 minutes, he rang me back, and he said, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and it's something, I've forgotten the actual verse, but it's near the end, something like verse 25. So I hope you will now remember it is there. And HPB, you see, HPB refers to this, the Pauline division, spirit, soul, and body. And so in the same way, the poet refers to these. Know thou thyself. As thou hast learnt of me, I made thee three in one and one in three. Spirit and mind and form, immortal whole, divine and undivided trinity. Seek not to break the triple bond assigned. Mind sees by spirit. Body moves by mind. Divorced from spirit, both waywildered fall. Leader and led, the blindfold and the blind. Up to this point, I have kept to the order of the verses in the poem. But now I'm going to take verses from other parts which serve my particular presentation rather more than the order that the poet has used. We have always to remember the climate of Christian thought at that time and for long afterwards and here and there still today. That is the view that man is essentially bad, sinful. When my sisters and I used to go to learn the catechism at the convent, the nuns greeted us by saying, hello all you little sinners. Well, perhaps if they had seen further ahead, they would have said it more strongly. Now, that, in the view of the wisdom tradition, is a mistake. And so in one of the verses I'm going to quote, there is a word, an English word, good dictionary word, but it is not much used, and there may be a few people who have not come across it, although I'm sure that many of you have. An ordinary word, the word palimpsest. Palimpsest means the parchment or other substance on which writing was done, and it was so precious that when you wanted to do some more, you scratched out what had already been there and you used the vellum or whatever it was all over again. And so the poet uses that thought, the idea of rubbing out mistaken ideas. Say, thou who deemest thyself the child of sin, how, God begotten, wast thou born therein? Lo, I thy father, I thy mother am. Wouldst claim the heritage, thy birthright win. Erase that record of the palimpsest within thee by the scribe of time impressed. And on the smoothed surface write anew, I am all wisdom, righteousness, and rest. Some of you will remember that Damodar made a mistake in writing down a letter for the Mahatma M. He got it wrong. He got the message wrong, and the Mahatma M thought that it would upset Hume. And so the only thing to do was to scratch it out, and write over the top what would not offend Mr. Hume, whose sensibilities were somewhat touchy, as you know. And you'll find references to that in letter 73 and 74 of the Mahatma letters. If what the preacher said is true, know ye not that ye are the temple, there is no need to go outside for help. All the help that we need at any time, all the strength that we need, is within. Look not without thee. Thou hast that within makes whole thy sickness, impotent thy sin. Survey thy forces, rally to thyself. That which thou wouldst not hath no power to win. I am all love. There is naught else but I. I am all power. The rest is fantasy. Evil and anguish, sorrow, death and hell, these are the fear-flung shadows of a lie. I, God, enfold thee like an atmosphere. Thou to thyself wert never yet more near. Do we not I think it has been turned into a hymn, say, closer is he than breathing, and nearer than hands and feet? And does not HBB say that divine life is in all things, and she teaches her Englishman, even in his cigar ash, that life is present? He thinks of it as blasphemy, and she says, no, it is logic, just that. If the divine life is everywhere, it cannot be blasphemous to say it is in this particular place. Fold thee like an atmosphere. Thou to thyself wert never yet more near. Think not to shun me. Whither wouldst thou fly? Nor go not hence to seek me. I am here. There is a passage in one of the Psalms which says the sort of thing which HPB and the secret doctrine and the theosophical teaching has said always, and yet it seems to be contradicted in popular versions of preaching Christianity. But here it is in the Psalms. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. Exactly the same, the universal presence, which HPB speaks of, the one life all, in all places. Let me repeat the verse. I, God, enfold thee like an atmosphere. Thou to thyself wert never yet more near. Think not to shun me. Whither wouldst thou fly? Nor go not hence to seek me. I am here. And then, why should we look elsewhere for satisfaction? I liked what Ed said last night about looking horizontally, more and more things, further and further away for our satisfaction, help, happiness. And yet man does that because he is caught up in the world of sensory experience. There is a verse in the Upanishad which says, which blames it all on the power that started everything. It's his fault. The self-existent made the senses turn outward. And so man looks at what is without and does not look at what is within. Rare is he who, longing for immortality, shuts his eyes to what is without and looks within at the self. And so the divine voice urges man to look within. Hush thee, if thou wouldst hear it. Still and small, my voice to thee makes answer ere thou call. Ah, to the hidden word thou givest no heed, and clamorous echo deemest all in all. And I wonder whether the clamorous echo does not include lectures on theosophy. We waste time and energy on trivialities, on worthless things, on the unreal instead of the real. In the Vivekachudamani, Sri Shankara uses very strong language for that person, to describe that person who, having the opportunity to study the scriptures, and therefore knowing the truth, at least in theory, instead runs after the things of earth and the things of time. He speaks of that person as a suicide because he is throwing a life away. He knows the alternative, but he chooses to shut his eyes. And in At the Feet of the Master, where the teaching classifies people into those who know and those who do not know, and says those who do not know work for things like power and wealth and so on, but those who know recognize there are greater things than these. There are greater things. The thriftless joys that are thy heart's desire, base or unsearched of the refiner's fire, can these pass current with the high-born soul that unto heavenly riches doth aspire? And At the Feet of the Master says, when once the real has been seen, the thirst for the unreal drops away. And yet this does not mean despising or turning entirely away from the world of sense. It has its place and it has its value because the divine life is present in all. And there is one passage from a Upanishad that has been repeated quite often in our literature. It is not for the sake of the wife that the wife is dear, but for the sake of the self. It is not for the sake of the child that the child is dear, but for the sake of the self. It is not for the sake of the higher worlds that the higher worlds are dear, but for the sake of the self, and so on. All things are embodiments of that self. The mistake is to consider only the embodiment and not that which it embodies. To pay attention to the appearances, to the outer coating, and to ignore the life. Somewhere there is a verse, I don't know if I shall come to it, which goes like, imagine a rose. Yon palpitating ray thou callest a rose. Thou seest the light that in its bosom glows, but that which thrills behind it, he alone who knows to commune with its maker knows. That unity with the life and nature that you have expressed by Krishnamurti when he felt himself to be one with the grass, one with the blades coming through. And Dr. Arundel also, being the orange grove, being Dr. Arundel at one moment and being the orange grove at the next, and this shift of consciousness between the two. If there is nothing but the one, as we've said repeatedly, the hidden life and the hidden love, then there is nowhere where that is not. And I was, in connection with the next verse, reminded of Walt Whitman's passage to India, and as he was a good American citizen, I hope you know this. First let me read the verse from the poem and then the passage from Walt Whitman. You see, the divine life is everywhere, one cannot get away from it. What billoweth else behind thee or before? What else thine element? Do ships ashore fear launching for the scantness of the sea? Put forth, and thou shalt doubt no more. And so I had to select a very small part of Walt Whitman's passage to India. I'd like to have the whole thing, but no, we can't. In any case, I haven't brought it down. Oh, we can wait no longer. We too take ship, O soul, joyous. We too launch out on trackless seas, fearless for unknown shores, on waves of ecstasy to sail. Passage to more than India. Passage, immediate passage. Have we not darkened and dazed ourselves with books long enough? I can hear Krishnamurti saying, hear, hear. Have we not darkened and dazed ourselves with books long enough? Sail forth, steer for the deep waters only. Oh, my brave soul, oh, farther, farther, further sail. Oh, daring joy, but safe. Are they not all the seas of God? So the verse once more. What billoweth else behind thee or before? What else thine element? Do ships ashore fear launching for the scantness of the sea? Put forth and thou shalt doubt no more. And now the divine teacher holds out before man the prospect of his glorious future, if he will but turn within and realize his divinity. Thy times are in my hand, who say to thee, the past is nothing, let the future be. Thou, whom I fashioned for my heart's desire, art not of time, but of eternity. But man is caught up in this world of the senses, with the phenomenal world around him, as the Katha Upanishad says, and so the Lord calls to him, oh, my beloved. You remember how many times in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna addresses Arjuna with a term such as that, my beloved. How many times does he say, thou art my friend. I shall tell you my supreme secret, because thou art beloved of me. O my beloved, heir to mine estate, come to me swiftly, though the hour be late. Those my five envoys, whom I sent to seek, have lured thee from me, and alone I wait. Now these five envoys are the five senses, and serious consideration of the function of the senses would help considerably our understanding. They are, of course, wonderful. Eyes to see, ears to hear, the five senses show us the outside world. But did we but realize it? They cut off a great deal more than they reveal. So much that we cannot see, so much that we cannot hear, so much to which we are totally insensitive. And yet we fail to recognize that because of the wonders. Perhaps they are enough for us for the time being. But there they are. Those my five envoys, whom I sent to seek, have lured thee from me, and alone I wait. And wait. What for? In the very first letter, in the Mahatma letters, there is, I don't know, there are several words in italics, but there is one word or two words in italics which strike me as so significant. The deific powers in man. The deific powers in man. And it is for that that the Lord here is waiting. The emergence of those deific powers. I wait to see thy feet with wisdom shod, disease and error banished at thy nod, sinless, self-dominant, adult, divine. I wait to see thee walk the earth a God. To realize himself, we speak of self-realization. Perhaps I know I have mentioned to some people what Dr. Bendit said, whether he said it in Crotona when he was there, or whether he's written it in a book, I don't remember, meeting a friend. The friend said, I'm not quite sure which way round it was, whether the friend to Dr. Bendit or the other way round. And one of the two said, oh, how are you? To which the reply was, oh, I'm perfect, but I have some difficulty in manifesting it. Try that answer next time anyone asks you. And this indeed is just the future that the Upanishad holds out. What is the state of the man who has achieved self-realization? Self-kingship he attains. Lordship of mind he wins. Lord over sense. Lord over sight. Of hearing, Lord. Lord of understanding. Then he becometh Brahm. That final identification of the part with the whole. One of the most magnificent passages, well, there are so many, yes. Self-kingship he attains. Lordship of mind he wins. Lord over sense, Lord over sight. Of hearing, Lord, Lord of understanding. Then he becometh Brahm. And so this beautiful verse that looks into that future. I wait to see thy feet with wisdom shod, disease and error banished at thy nod, sinless, self-dominant, adult, divine. I wait to see thee walk the earth, a God. And the way to this realization, as always, is within. The age-old path of meditation, the listening. But enter thou thy closet, shut thy door, and seek the silence of the golden floor. The way of meditation and the seeking of the power within, because it is there that the divine power is. I think I may have quoted this verse only a week ago in one of my talks somewhere around here. That which thou art, thou dreamest not, so vast that lo, time present, time to be, time past, are but the sepals of thine opening soul, whose flower shall fill the universe at last. If one had to choose one verse more than any other, perhaps that is the one that I would choose to remember. There is a passage that when I was studying this some time ago, I was reminded of Dr. Besant, something that she said in her popular lectures. And I never heard other of our leaders, but not in 1930 when she came to Europe, but I didn't hear her. But in her popular lectures, there is this passage which must have been rousing, spoken with all her command of oratory. It's quite legendary. You are children of heaven, living upon earth. You are gods in the making. You are of royal birth, sons of a king. Will you not realize your nature and claim your birthright? Your crown is shining above you. Will you not wear it? Your throne is vacant. Will you not ascend it and rule the kingdom which belongs to you? Will you not take your birthright as the sons of God, and lifting up your eyes, claim the heritage which is yours? That in the Queen's Hall must have been something, as we say. Perhaps we're told, I think, that our humanity has passed the lowest point and is now just beginning the upward climb. And if that is so, then it is time to do, as Dr. Besant says, to claim the power. Claim then that power, the which within thee lies, waiting thy royal mandate to arise. Woo then that wisdom, for thine own she is. Woo her and win and know that thou art wise. But this is not for man alone. As he grows in realization, he will come to recognize his responsibility for all other creatures that share the earth with him. And that too is suggested by the poet. And I would like to give you just one or two verses which suggest that. Verse 66 is particular, where man recognizes his responsibility and then in their turn the creatures of the earth recognize him. Thus, having learned that love is law confessed, and seeing through all my universe expressed my seamless garment broidered o'er with worlds, the unresting order which alone is rest, thou shalt harmonious move. And at thy nod, my children of the air, the sea, the sod, finding thee merciful, shall milder grow, learn of thy ways, and look to thee as God. Now I'm going to come to the last verse, and I would like to suggest that we have just a moment of silence after it, not our usual display of enthusiasm, which I hope you have felt for some of this magnificent work, but instead just absorb the last poem, and then we'll have a moment of silence. It ends as it began. I am thy dawn from darkness to release. I am the deep wherein thy sorrows cease. Be still. Be still and know that I am God. Acquaint thyself with me and be at peace.